Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Now that Northwest communities have turned back nearly every coal and oil project proposed for the region, the, quote, natural gas industry is upping its ante in the Northwest. Actually, before massive coal and oil export terminals began to threaten Oregon and Washington, liquid natural gas, or LNG, import facilities were proposed in Coos Bay and near Astoria, Oregon. These subsequently morphed into export facilities and started drawing intense opposition from across the state. The Astoria projects have been stopped, but the Coos Bay project continues to rear its head. And now another LNG facility in Tacoma is being built without all its necessary permits in place, despite opposition from local residents in the Puyallup tribe. And a new player, methanol, has come to town as well. Today we talk with Longview, Washington community activist Diane Dix about the world's largest methanol refinery being proposed for Kalama, Washington, and the growing opposition it has sparked. And we'll also be talking about LNG. In fact, I think we're going to start by talking about LNG. So Diane, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you for having me.
I think it was your idea we should start with LNG. Because the industry started with LNG when they started focusing on the Northwest.
That's correct.
So let's talk a little bit about your past with LNG and how that led into your current opposition to methanol.
Thank you. I've lived in Cowlitz County 33 years, and 6 years ago, I got involved with a local group called LCSC, now known as Lower Columbia Stewardship Council, and that was actively fighting the 44 million ton a year Millennium Bulk Coal Terminal export. This group had gotten started, though, opposing the Bradwood Landing LNG import terminal on the Columbia River, and later was opposing the Warrenton LNG export terminal. So both of these gas projects failed, and the Warrenton project failed in 2016.
So I want to talk a little bit about geography for a moment, because I'm thinking about how long it took me in the years I lived in Portland before I realized that the Columbia River was that river you saw along I-5 as you're driving through Kalama and Longview and Kelso. And so let's talk about the relationship of the Columbia River and the towns along it and why you would be so impacted by what was going on in Astoria. So reminding people that actually the Columbia River does not just run east-west, but just west of Portland, it starts to run north.
That's correct. I-5 runs north-south, as we all know. And the Columbia River from Vancouver runs north along the west side of I-5 until you reach Kalama and Longview, at which it takes a left-hand bend and heads westward towards the coast and Astoria and Warrenton.
So actually, when there was all these plans for putting LNG terminals in little communities outside of Astoria, whether it was Warrenton, where the last one held on until 2 years ago, or west of
at Bradwood Landing, just west of Longview on the Oregon side of the
river. About 25 miles, I guess. East of Astoria. That actually does impact you because you're not in the estuary, but you're sort of at a point in the river where it's very different than it is once you get the part of the Columbia River that most Portlanders are familiar with.
It's an important juncture point because where the Columbia River makes that bend westward, we not only have on the east side, we have I-5, but just east of I-5, there is the major main Williams Northwest gas pipeline at that point. And also the BNSF main rail line runs along I-5 north-south. So we're at that point where those transportation routes intersect. And
so there's like the river, there's the... It's interesting because there's actually four transportation routes because I think the river is a transportation route, but it's the oldest transportation route.
Correct.
And then we have the freeway, which is one of the newer ones, the railroad, which is not as old as the river, but it's newer than the other two.
It's been there a long time.
And then the one nobody knows about, which is that pipeline. So let's talk a little bit about that pipeline and what kind the role that it's playing in the push to turn the Northwest, as Donald Trump sees, we should be like the leading LNG export facility in the world.
Yes, it's extraordinary that Washington should be thought of as an LNG or natural gas or fracked gas export port because Washington State produces no natural gas. It all comes in from Canada or comes in from the Rocky Mountain areas to the south and east. So this main pipeline will draw Canadian fracked gas at the border point at Sumas, Washington, and almost all of the gas that we get at this point comes from Canada down this main pipeline in western Washington all the way down here to Portland. It can be a bidirectional pipe, so if there are peak times like the cold weather times in January, December, sometimes they have to bring gas in from the east, from Washougal, Camas, where there are other pipelines that intersect.
So how long has that pipeline been around? And that pipeline predates fracking, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. It's over 50 years old. It's an old pipeline.
And it used to be, because we've been getting our natural gas from British Columbia for a long time, but it used to be produced in a different way. So let's, before we get into LNG itself, what's the difference between the gas that I'm using to heat myself now, now, and the gas that I was using to heat myself when I put the first furnace in into our house 25 years ago?
I honestly don't know, unless you're talking about fracking.
that's the point. The gas, I don't know the quality and difference between frack gas and the stuff. But how did gas used to be produced, and why did we think it was a clean fuel 25 years ago?
I am not an expert in how gas was produced 25 years ago. Natural gas is basically methane, and we've been familiar with methane a long time. There are various biological processes that produce methane, but most of the methane that had easily been recovered had been from oil wells or simply gas wells themselves. And so it's only been in about the last 6 years, that the process of fracking, in which these tight gas and oil areas, in other words, the gas was trapped tightly in the formations, were able to be accessed by pushing hydraulic fracking fluid, proppants down into the well and cracking those rocks and releasing the gas, and essentially freeing up gas that had been trapped in the rock layers.
So the big difference used to be that there was abundant reservoirs of gas that weren't that far from the surface, same way that there used to be abundant reservoirs of oil.
Yes.
And now we're basically having to crack and shatter shale formations to get it.
And using a lot more resources to do that, and bringing proppants in from Asia and other places to help us do that. So there are a lot more resources going into actually producing the gas that we're recovering now.
Now, I'm not sure if this is your purview, but I've talked to a couple people in the last few weeks that talk about how cheap gas is now. Now, my impression when I first learned about fracking is a very expensive procedure, much more expensive than just getting gas out of the traditional wells that were drying up 20 years ago and gas was going way up in price. And now gas is the cheapest fuel there is, probably. And in fact, its abundance and its cheapness is a threat to the renewable energy industry as well. Do you have any understanding how this process is so expensive? We could be producing gas that's so cheap.
Again, I'm not fully knowledgeable on that process. Of course, it all has to do with markets, and they're not going to do it unless they can make a profit off of it. And as I understand it, gas became so cheap because it was basically a byproduct of the oil industry. And when oil was $100 a barrel, it made sense to frack. And as a byproduct of that, they've got all of this natural gas besides. In some areas, the Bakken Formation, they simply flared this gas off. I understand down in the oil fields of Texas, they have infrastructure in place where they can actually pipe the gas from the oil fields into collection areas a lot easier than, say, the North Dakota or perhaps even the Alaskan areas. So this basically became an extra asset that they realized they could make money off of. And it basically drove down the price of natural gas because it was so abundant at that point.
Well, one of the things that I've been hearing a lot from people like you and other people I've been talking to up in Tacoma is that the Canadians really their biggest challenge with all the gas that they're producing up in Alberta and British Columbia is they don't have a market for it unless they can get it out here. It's the same story as the oil and why the Vancouver oil rail terminal was being promoted. And
correct.
And now that it's gone, fortunately. So what are these market pressures and how does that tie into some of these proposals, whether it's for the LNG projects or whether it's for the methanol projects, which we'll talk about in a moment?
I think it ties into an excess of product needing a market. And we basically are one of the closest ports to the Asian Rim, where there's a lot of economic activity needing energy resources. Besides the impact in of natural gas, there's also been the impact of all of that crude oil being produced by fracking to the point that the pipelines were not sufficient. And so we were seeing an influx of crude by rail, and that included even some of the lighter condensates like propane and butane, which there were also proposals in Longview for, which we managed to defeat also in the last couple of years. So we've seen the results of the increased oil production in various ways.
So basically, we are the shortest route.
We're the shortest point between here and there.
Now, it seems like the days of the Northwest becoming the major shipping points for oil and coal are probably past. There's one terminal up in your way in Longview, which is not totally dead, but it's
right.
Floundering around. It's on major life support. I'd say it's comatose right now.
Yes, Millennium Bulk Terminals.
But the new push now is gas.
Yes.
So what's the difference, do you think, in dealing with either promoting or trying to stop these gas facilities with the efforts to stop the oil and the coal for terminals?
I think part of the problem has been that the gas products are being marketed in different ways. They're not actually being marketed as gas or as LNG. They're being marketed as further refined products such as methanol and ammonia. So there's more processing being done using our water and our electricity, and they're processing it into a product that they claim will be greener. It's greenwashing. And it's more easily transportable by ship. LNG terminals require a lot more regulation than methanol or other products.
Well, in a few weeks, I'm probably going to do a show about the great new the LNG terminal. Well, actually, it's a processing plant and possible export facility in Tacoma, which is interesting because it doesn't have all its permits yet, but it's still
right.
It's still going forward. But for now, I think we're going to spend the rest of this time talking about methanol. You're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and at KBFG-FM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Longview community activist Diane Dix about plans to build the world's largest methanol refinery in Kalama, Washington. So first of all, where is Kalama? For those people who've been blind as they drive up to Seattle along 95.
Kalama is about 40 miles north of Portland and about 9 miles south of Longview.
Oh, actually,
and across from St. Helens.
Right, so it's right across the river. It's one of those river towns.
It's a river town. It's right on the river. It was formed when the railway came through over 100 years ago.
And one of the things that was always distinctive to me and why I did notice Kalama on my trips up to Seattle beginning back many, many years ago is that it's a city that rises up on these hills. So I want to talk a little bit about just kind of the location and what its attraction is, other than, I mean, why it's so attractive in so many ways and so unique compared to some of the other towns along the river, and then what's going on the west side of the freeway across from this wonderful town on the hill.
Yes, on the east side of I-5, as you look into those hills, there are lovely, these Victorian-style houses there that have been there for, some of them probably at least a century. And the town used to be known as a mecca for antique stores. That has gone away a little bit, and so they are looking for new sources of economic activity. But it's been a quiet little community. It's only a population of about 2,000 people within the city borders, but there are other people outside of those borders that share in that quality of life, that small town quality of life that people value. Lately, we've had a lot more retired people who move there. The views from the hills are absolutely outstanding if you're able to get up above I-5 and view the countryside. So it is. There are people who retire there for the views, for the quiet, for the small town community, for the ability to go down and fish. The Port of Kalama has a lovely marina, so it's quite accessible to the public at that point.
And you're fishing in the Columbia River.
You're fishing in the Columbia River, and also there is the Kalama River nearby, which has one of the oldest fish hatcheries in the state.
But on the other side of the freeway, on the west side of the freeway, it took me a few years to kind of put it together that all this industry that's the Port of Kalama had to do with this beautiful town on the right side of the freeway or on the east side of the freeway. But what's the relationship between the port and the town in terms of, I mean, because as opposed to Longview, which basically when you go through Longview, it looks pretty industrial from the freeway. But in Kalama, there was this real clash between the town and the port. And I wonder how those two realities coexist in that community.
It's interesting. I-5 sort of divides the town itself from the riverfront because you have that natural barrier of I-5 and there's only actually one entrance to the shoreline from the Kalama side. And then west of the freeway, between the freeway and the river, there is the BNSF main line, and they have increased the track there. They use it as a staging area, switching area for a lot of their freight. And of course, Amtrak also goes through there. It's the only route through there. You also have that area developed as grain export terminals. It's both Longview and Kalama are major export terminals for wheat and other grains that come from east of the mountains and from the Midwest.
So it seems to me that Kalama and Longview, to a little lesser degree, has traditionally been like an export center for farm products and for wood products, and that there's also a history of sawmills and other things related to the wood industry. Has there ever been anything closely resembling fossil fuel development in either of these ports?
No.
So that's the thing. That's what seems to be jolting a lot of people, is that we're used to the ravages of resource extraction in this region, particularly in terms of forestry. And we're also used to being, from Portland all the way up to Longview, a major shipping hub for all the wheat that's grown in eastern Oregon. But we're not used to fossil fuels coming. So why is it such a jarring thought to become a export central for fossil fuels?
I think that probably took us a little bit by surprise because we had been proud of ourselves as an export facility. Longview began about 1920s ended up with having the largest sawmill in the world at that time. So we've always been proud of the fact that we were an industrial area that produced a lot of jobs and produced a lot of finished products that we could sell to the world. And then we have the grain terminals that came in. And so it was seen as a good thing. I'm not sure we were really prepared to understand what the petroleum industry was offering us and what the drawbacks would be at that point.
So how has that educational process moved along?
It's been rather slow. Before we actually had the LNG impacted us at first because it would bring a new pipeline or it would bring expanded pipelines through Cowlitz County and to the Columbia River. And people are protective of their property and what goes through their property. So the pipelines have always raised a red flag for the people who are actually living along them. So they understood natural gas from that point as far as the pipelines. But as far as the terminals and their effect and the magnitude of petroleum products, that was something different that we have slowly had to educate ourselves on.
Well, what's interesting, we should actually talk a little bit about this methanol refinery itself that's being proposed and a little bit of its history, and then talk about the impact that the pipeline's going to have, because there's many different impacts that it has. So first of all, what is this methanol refinery that's being proposed, and what makes it so unique?
This methanol refinery was first proposed, came to the public's attention at a port meeting in January of 2014. They proposed this refinery then, and only a couple days later proposed a sister refinery across the river at Port Westward. They provided numbers as to what it would do. They said it was going to help reduce coal use in China, that it would be a green product, it would provide a lot of jobs.
What is methanol?
Methanol is methane refined into a liquefied form with the help of water and electricity inputs. And it is a methyl alcohol. It's a type of alcohol. It's been called wood alcohol. So it's been methanol has been known for a long time. And it can be used as a precursor for olefins for plastic. It can be used as a fuel. It's been used in race cars as a fuel for quite a long time.
And so what was particularly concerning for you and other people in the community about this refinery? Why were you concerned that it was being built in the community, and what issues did it raise?
In 2014, we still had a hard time understanding exactly what this facility would look like, because we were not familiar with methanol refineries. There are no methanol refineries in the state of Washington. And we sort of had to dig for information on it. The first red flag was that they would need a new 3.1 Kalama lateral gas pipeline, a new pipeline from the Williams Northwest Main Pipeline, which is east of town, that would connect with the port. This pipeline immediately set up red flags for the people who lived along there, because there had been previous gas projects proposed at the same site at the Port of Kalama, and so they understood what this pipeline would mean for them. There had also been some fiery explosions along the main pipeline within the last 10, 15 years, and these people were well aware of the dangers of having a pipeline in their backyard. So the immediate opposition, I would say, was to the pipeline, and the project basically divided up into two parts. It divided up into the new pipeline that would be needed, and the facility site. There was also a new a dock that would be required at the port, and so there were sort of three little projects that they sort of tried to divide our attention amongst. So the first thing was the pipeline, and that had an environmental review under the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and that proceeded in 2014 and 15. The scoping process for the environmental review.
So scoping,
yeah, I have to explain what scoping is.
Actually, because we're going to be talking mm-hmm. about people getting involved in the scoping, a new scoping process. So what is scoping?
Scoping is when the public is allowed to ask all the questions they want to know of a project and have those questions reviewed in an environmental review, which comes later. So you can ask anything. You can ask, what are the economic impacts? What are the water impacts? What are the impacts on emergency responders? So wildlife, fish. So that's where you ask all those questions up front. And then that follows with a draft environmental impact statement that attempts to answer all of those questions. Then there is the opportunity for the public to comment on that. So that impact statement then comes back in a final form. The permitting agencies then use that environmental impact statement, along with any other materials they might have, to make decisions on permit applications, like the shoreline permits, air discharge permits, water permits, water quality permits. There are a multitude of permits that need to be in place for any of these projects to go forward, and the environmental impact statement helps to inform that.
So back to the scoping process. Mm-hmm. So you started the scoping process.
I believe it was in 2015 that we did the scoping process on that. It did not garner a lot of attention at that point, basically because we were also involved with fighting a butane propane terminal at Longview. We were still fighting coal around the state and crude by rail to Saro, all of that. So around in the spring of 2016 is when the draft environmental impact statement for the methanol facility itself was released. And so we wanted to make sure that the community and, of course, the broader environmental groups already knew about it, were there to review and take seriously this environmental impact statement so we would know what actually was going to be used or what was going to be asked of the community to host this very large facility. It was not until then that I did some research and realized it would be the largest methanol refinery in the world. The promoters of this had never, and to this day, have never stated that this would be the largest methanol refinery in the world.
How'd you figure out that it was?
I got on the internet and started looking for methanol refiners, where they were located, how much they produced, and I found the next largest one was proposed for Iran, right on the Gulf, right off of their oil fields.
So it seems like there aren't that many methanol refineries, period, right now. I mean, they're using methane to produce methanol as opposed to...
Actually, there are a lot of methanol refineries. A lot of them that we have seen have been down in the Caribbean, Trinidad, Tobago. And most of the refineries are actually a lot smaller. And you can go online and find methanol refineries for sale. You could pick some of these small ones up and move them around. And so because a lot of natural gas at that point came out of the Gulf of Mexico, you would tend to find a lot of this methanol associated with other petroleum-producing areas, such as the Gulf.
But it seems like the big difference with this refinery, besides being so large, was also the process they were using.
Yes, that's an interesting situation. The original process that they had proposed that we had first seen would use a more standard process in which they use their natural gas feedstock to also produce power in power generators. They need a lot of power to produce this methanol. And while they were looking over the ramifications of that process, they realized that the pollution released by the power generation units themselves would create so much pollution that it would be uneconomical to mitigate for it. So at that point, they went over to this ultra-low emissions, as it's called, ULE process, which is a fairly new process that, as I understand, has only been tried in Australia on a less than industrial scale. So it's not a standard industrial scale type of production. And in using this production, they would be able to use electricity from the public power grid. They would need about 200 megawatt load overall for their process. And they would be able to provide 100 megawatts of their own. And then the public power system only had available about 90 to 100 megawatts. And so they decided that they could use that with a little bit of local infrastructure improvement that the company would pay for.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on Cambridge Community Radio, and we're talking with Diane Dix, who's from Longview, who's been fighting the fossil fuel industry up on that leg of the Columbia River for a good many years. And we're talking today about plans to build the world's largest methanol refinery in Kalama. Now, I was at a hearing a little over a year ago on a very cold day up in Longview, and it was, I forget which permit they were going after. I think it might have been the shoreline permit, but I'm not sure. It might have been the air permit. But there were a lot of people there who were very much in favor of this refinery and were talking about all the jobs. And there were also probably many more people who were very much opposed to the refinery and were talking about the pollution and the climate change issues and a lot of the other health concerns. And one of the contentious things was this low emission
ultra-low emission process.
Right. And I remember this guy saying that after arguing with some of the opponents, saying it's not an unproven thing, that he was an engineer and he knew all about it and he knew it worked and he was using some example of some case where it worked. Was he talking, just pulling things out of his head, or did he have any grounds at all for what he was saying?
I don't know. We actually have never been given any examples of where this process has been used on an industrial scale. The Chinese group of people that put together this new company they formed a new company to promote these refineries as far as I know, don't operate any other methanol refineries. So I would not consider it trustworthy business operation, or if they wanted to convince the local people that this was a really good thing, I would look for other business, large corporations or businesses that are actually running a facility with this type of process and proving that it is possible and that it's viable and what the implications and consequences are of having such a facility in their community. That's one reason I looked to find out where these other methanol refineries were.
Well, it's interesting to me that who's owning and these different proposed projects. In the case of the refinery in Calama, it's a company that's actually owned by the Chinese government. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then down in Coos Bay, Jordan Cove is now owned by Pembina, which was infamous here a few years ago in Portland when they wanted to build a liquid propane terminal. And Pembina actually is a Calgary, Alberta-based company. And then the company that wants to build the LNG production facility in Tacoma, it's owned by a company called Puget Sound Energy. They're actually owned in Australia. So I find it interesting that these projects are all coming from not just out of state, but out of the country, and wonder what kind of impact that has on your community.
Well, we look at it as far as their credibility when they say that they're going to be using local workers, because we know we have no local unemployed petrochemical refinery workers in Longview. We also know that some of these projects are highly technical, so they would need to bring skilled people in from elsewhere.
From China, perhaps?
From China or Texas, who knows? It's interesting, Millennium Bulk Terminals is also an Australian company. It's interesting that when you hear the names of the Canadian producers, before Pembina, Pembina had bought Veresen, which is also a Canadian company, and Veresen was one that had promoted the prior gas project at the Port of Calama. So you find that you get some of the same player names when it comes to promoting the gas, especially.
It's kind of an aside, but I noticed that these companies are always changing the name. Like Tesoro Savage changed their name in the last few months before Governor Inslee announced the death sentence for that terminal. And whatever their new name is, it hasn't stuck because nobody can remember what it is.
I think it's Antero or something like that. But you're right. It has numerous name changes. And actually, if you look up the Northwest Innovation Works project in Calama, you'll find it's called the Calama Manufacturing and Marine Export Facility, KMMEF. And it is an offspring of the Chinese Academy of Science Holdings owned by the Chinese government. It doesn't tell you a whole lot. You try and research who these people are. And when you're not getting good information, then it raises questions in your mind as far as the financial viability of these projects, because we have seen too often that you have speculators come in, they put a project together, they, you know, run the initial financials on it, they try and get the permits, and then we don't know if they're going to sell it out to somebody else or who is actually going to run it. There's also the possibility that some of these facilities could be changed into another project. I mean, the Calama facility is right along the BNSF mainline. They are going to have huge storage tanks on liquefaction, earthquake-prone soils there. So we don't know if this project goes away, if they would bring in an oil storage facility or attempt to use that facility for something else.
Well, it seems that there's a split in the community. I wanted to get back to the issue about jobs, because people seem to believe, at least certain quarters of your community believe, that you need the jobs and this project will provide jobs. And then there's other people, and you sort of express that viewpoint, that the jobs aren't going to be going to local people. And then it's a question of, well, how many jobs there really are. So let's talk about why well, in a way, why Kalama and Longview are like magnets for these kinds of projects these days. What is the appeal in the community, and what are these companies thinking is perhaps a soft spot in the community that would embrace them?
I think that we've been seen as an economically disadvantaged area of the state for quite a while. We began as, Longview especially, began as an industrial port town. And so people grew up with the idea that with heavy industry, you accept pollution, you accept noise, you accept a lot of things. When the woods industry started losing jobs due to technology and other factors in the 1990s, we saw a lot of unemployment due to that. And then when the Reynolds aluminum smelter shut down in 2000, we saw 400 people thrown out of work. So there has certainly been the feeling in our community that we needed jobs, and that because they understood heavy industry, that heavy industry could provide a solution to some of that. So that meant instead of pursuing multiple diverse types of small businesses, I think a lot of our local leadership were looking for large projects. Large projects are also attractive to the building trades union because it means, you know, even temporarily, it means a lot of work for the building trades. So between a populace that is used to having heavy industry in their midst, leadership that is looking to provide jobs for people, and a skilled workforce here that can certainly create these facilities, then I think it has attracted these, along with the fact that geographically, location, location, location. I mean, we're in that spot that is helpful for profitability.
Well, one difference that I see between Kalama and Longview, I mean, Longview is mm-hmm. really an industrial town. It's kind of like a miniature Tacoma in a way.
In a way.
In a way. It's still yeah. a long way. I've just spent mm-hmm. some time in Tacoma and mm-hmm. just learned a few more things about the serious problems that they have up there still. But Kalama is not. I mean, when you describe Kalama, I mean, there is the industry that's west of the freeway, but it has a very different sense of itself. Now, has there been a certain level of pollution already endemic in Kalama from the existing industry that this would just exacerbate, or is pollution a new thing?
There has already been pollution. While you see the grain terminals, there are chemical manufacturers along the west side there on the riverbanks. There's Emerald Kalama Chemical, which has fallen under the Washington Model Toxics Control Act for cleanup of things like toluene. There are industries there that make use of a lot of industrial chemicals and produce some. So, and Longview itself produces some industrial chemicals also.
So there's been concern that I've heard that people figured just because this area has a history of pollution and contamination, why would we want to make it worse? Do you think that in some ways sum up some of the concerns about having this rather massive infrastructure being built for fossil fuels?
I think that's a large concern. While we were fighting some of these other projects, we are also trying to get the former Reynolds aluminum smelter cleaned up. It is still awaiting a cleanup plan for the decades of pollution that occurred while it was an aluminum smelter. This is the same site that Millennium wants to build on top of. And we were concerned at that point that this pollution be cleaned up before something else just came in and covered it up. We are right on the Columbia River, and so we have a strong natural resources appreciation in Kalama and Longview. Even though it is an industrial base, we see that river every day. People are on that river fishing. They understand the fishing industry. It's a huge industry, the tourist industry. I think we've got a greater appreciation of natural resources and the fact that we're not improving them, and that these will just continue to degrade the quality of the environment and the way of life that we have appreciated.
Well, another concern, too, has to do with looking at the larger climate change issues. And what would be the impact of expanding this gas pipeline that runs along I-5, as well as building the lateral pipeline? What are your concerns besides the dangers of it blowing up now in terms of more long-term climate change issues?
The methanol refinery will produce up to 6 million metric tons of greenhouse gases per year, according to the latest report from the Stockholm Research Group. We knew even in the final EIS that the facility on site would produce over 1 million metric tons. So it's not insignificant with this single facility. If you brought in a larger pipeline, we know that that would allow other natural gas, fracked gas projects to go forward. As it is now, this pipeline does not have the capacity, even for firm transportation, for everything that this methanol refinery would need to run at full capacity. So there is the addition of all these greenhouse gases from additional natural gas projects is huge. Right now, according to our latest stats, Washington State as a whole is producing 94.4 million metric tons a day. And we need to get down to the 1990 target levels of about 88 million metric tons. So we're already producing 6 million more metric tons per year than our target for 2020. And this project would add 6 million metric tons instead of reducing 6 million metric tons. So we cannot continue to have more natural gas infrastructure projects that are going to continue leaking greenhouse gases into the air if we hope to reduce that pile of carbon instead of piling it on.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio and on KBFG FM in Seattle. We're talking this morning about the plans to build the world's largest methanol refinery in Clamor, Washington, just about 40 miles north of here in Portland. And we're talking with Longview community activist Diane Dix. Well, one thing that just keeps coming to my mind is all this information. You have this big notebook here with all kinds of stuff. And how you and a lot of other people that I've talked to in Clamor and Longview and also in Tacoma, you know so much. How did you, I guess the term is citizen scientist, how did you even figure out how to find out what you needed to know in order to fight these projects?
We have had a lot of support from a lot of experts. We would not be able to provide the opposition that we have in Kalama without having had the experience of other projects. Columbia Riverkeeper has been huge in helping us organize against some of the other fossil fuel projects and helping us educate on what these, how the process works and the types of products that we're looking at. So we are able to bring in experts on natural gas and the explosive nature of some of these storage tanks. So we've been able to draw in a lot of expertise and also legal help. So over the years, you sort of accumulate some of this information. And once you've read one EIS, it makes it easier to glance through the next one.
And
so you
know
what you're looking for. Right.
You
talked about last year about air discharge permit. I did not know much about air discharge permit a year ago. I know a lot more. And since then, have looked at not only the one for the methanol, but also there was the one for Tesoro Savage. There are other ones. So you start finding the information where you can find it online. Like I say, we've had experts in the natural gas area help us out with a lot of how to understand a lot of that.
Oh, that's great. Well, it seemed that when I first got kind of tuned into this, which was a little over a year ago, it seemed to me and to a lot of other people that this refinery in Klamath was a done deal. And I know that the hearing that I went to a little over a year ago was rather discouraging because they didn't see a single elected official coming up and opposing it, unlike with the Tesoro Savage terminal, where the entire city council of Vancouver and everybody except the Port Commission in Vancouver was really opposed to it. So then something changed, and I want to talk about sort of the sea change that happened in the last few months, and if you're feeling a little bit more hopeful that maybe this project isn't a done deal.
I am hugely hopeful now.
So what happened?
What happened was that several coal terminals came off the table. These were defeated by the larger environmental groups working on this. So we were able to focus attention on some of the other issues. Crude by rail has been huge. And in the case of locally, we had fought to a propane butane terminal at the port, and that was defeated in 2016 and in 2017 when we had a change of port commissioners at the Port of Longview. Unfortunately, still a lot of our local governmental leadership has been supporting these projects. And our local daily newspaper has also been friendly toward any industrial project that came through town. So what has changed, I think, is that we were able to convince, or I think there was an understanding in the larger environmental community that natural gas was not a bridge fuel. That has been known in the scientific community for quite a few years, but I think it just finally came to the attention of a lot of environmentalists that this is a serious problem and that climate change is not going to wait for us, and time has grown short, and that natural gas is not going to solve any problems, and it's going to hamper it. So I think there came a connection was made last year that, yes, this is a huge project, for one. I think that's when we first publicly said this was the largest one in the world. You start saying this is the largest one in the world, you get a few people's attention. We also had the defeat of the methanol refinery in Tacoma, which brought a lot of attention to that.
And it was the same people.
It was the same people, and it would have been twice the size of what's proposed in Klamath. And there was just a huge outcry in Tacoma, and I give them every all kinds of respect that they were able to shut that down so quickly. At the same time, we were able to shut down the Warrington LNG project last year and the Washington expansion pipeline. So a lot of things came together where it looked like it would make this possible to actually oppose. And so we've found all the arguments that we can. The greenhouse gas issue became prominent at that point, and the environmental groups were able to coalesce and provide a lot of legal support to challenge some of these permits.
And so one of them was successfully challenged.
Yes. The shoreline permit was challenged. It was interesting because the environmental process was led by the port and the Cowlitz County. So the shoreline permit was approved, and at that point it had to go to the State Department of Ecology for review, and Department of Ecology reviewed it and sent it back with some mitigation requests, at which point our environmental groups, Columbia Riverkeeper, Center for Biological Diversity, etc., Earth Justice, appealed that, and it went to the State Shorelines Board. It's the State Shorelines Board that has sent it back for a supplemental environmental impact statement with the review, a full review of the greenhouse gas consequences from the wellhead all the way to delivery point in Asia, which is absolutely huge. It's probably going to be precedent setting for any other natural gas project in the state.
And that leads us to our coming announcement, which if you want to get involved in this, there's going to be a couple gatherings this week and next week where you can learn much more about this proposed methanol refinery and actually learn how to write comments for the scoping process that we were talking about a little earlier. So the first one is tomorrow night in Portland. It's at the Okay, it's at the Sierra Club office. It's 1821 Southeast Ankeny, and it's hosted by Stop Frack Gas PDX, which is becoming a new coalition, kind of like Stand Up to Oil and Power Past Coal, which is like we're working on the third leg of the fossil fuel trio. And Columbia Riverkeeper, 350 PDX, Oregon Sierra Club, Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and KBOO Radio are all sponsoring this gathering. Starts at 7 o'clock. You can come a little early at 6:30 and meet people and have some refreshments. It's Washington State hearings about, a Washington State hearings board overturned the permits, as Diane was just saying, and the environmental review that had been previously issued for the methanol refinery proposal. Now we must use this second chance by amassing large numbers of comments for the new environment impact study. The comment period's open now through March 1st, and so you can learn how to write comments at this meeting and then write them. If you want to really learn what's going on at Kalama and get to meet Diane, there's going to be a meeting in Kalama the following week. It's a week from tonight at 6 o'clock at the Kalama Community Building, which is at 216 Elm Street in Kalama. And I'll put all this information on the website for Locust Focus so you can find out more. And do you want to say anything more, Diane, about the meeting that's going to be happening in Kalama next week?
We welcome everybody to come, meet some of our local Kalama residents, and get to see a little bit of the town. It's just right off the freeway as you're coming north and up the hill a few blocks.
And I just wanted to kind of close out by just sort of following up on you were saying about how this was really below the radar for a really long time. And one of the things, as you described, that has helped people see it is that so many other projects have been defeated, that suddenly this one emerged. And that was my own experience as somebody who'd been tracking a lot of other things. And then I found out about this methanol refinery. And the shock to me is I found out how long it had been going on. So what do you think how do we get more people aware of it? And why is it important that people in the Portland area are as concerned as people in your neck of the woods?
I think we've raised the awareness of folks on a scientific level. I think they now understand fossil fuels better, and that fracked gas is a part of the energy situation that we need to address if we're going to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. It's an important part of understanding how to do that.
And so what's the next step after the scoping process?
The next step after the scoping process is that there will be the issuance of a draft environmental impact statement, which will have public hearings at which we will be able to comment and find out how they address some of these questions.
And one thing we didn't get into, but maybe we'll talk about another time, is there's a lot of political connections with the company NWIW. There's connections between your elected officials and them. And so we only have like 1 minute left, so we can't really talk about it much now. It's, I think, a whole conversation in itself. But do you see that there's a movement towards disentangling perhaps your elected officials in the Longview Kalama area from the fossil fuel industry that's trying to move in?
I would like to think that there is. It was very hopeful that we had a local citizen who opposed this project that was elected to mayor of Kalama this last fall. So that was a step in the right direction.
Even though the mayor doesn't have any direct say on it.
Correct.
But it's like the Vancouver City Council changing.
Yes.
So, well, I wish you the best of luck with all of this, and I'll be tracking it closely, and I'll see you next week in Kalama.
Thank you, Barbara.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We've been talking this morning with Longview, Washington community activist Diane Dix, and you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locust-focus. Next week, we'll be talking with Columbia Riverkeeper Conservation Director Dan Sears and Tom Carpenter and Liz Mattson with Hanford Challenge about the never-ending efforts to clean up the Hanford Nuclear Reservation if you thought you had problems in Longview. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. I want to thank you for listening, and remember the Kickstarter campaign that we have right now, and you can go to our website right now and join up and pledge to support that campaign. We're going to go out with some music by the Wild Chapatulas. Tomorrow is Mardi Gras, and just sort of a hats off to the New Orleans Gulf Coast, and the Louisiana Gulf Coast, which has been dealing with fossil fuel a lot longer than we have. Meet the boys on the battlefront. Meet
some rump. The prettiest little thing that I ever see. Mardi Gras engine down in New Orleans. Sold all night and he sold all day. Mardi Gras morning went all the way. Coming from all over town, Big Chief singing, gonna take 'em down. Jockey Mofito, Eli, hey, Indians are rulers on the holiday.